good morning, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. The time between dusk and dawn, well, I guess almost anything can happen because the last couple of days have been very rocky, and I owe you an explanation of sorts. We're under some kind of electronic computer attack. Last night there was a schedule screw-up, and frankly, I got quite ill in the middle of the evening getting ready, and I just decided because, you know, when everything's against you, sometimes it's just more important to give people a quality show, so that's why we ran Nareem. And I've had a number of emails thanking me because it's so dense and so incredibly packed with info that you actually need to listen to some of these shows more than once, which, of course, is why we have Club 19.5, which I'm so glad to announce is working much, much better. The number of people who can't get in and can't reconnect and don't remember their passwords and all that is going way down. The memberships are going up very nicely, which is important because it's with the memberships and the monetary subscription fees that we're going to have to be able to afford the kind of computer security to keep us on the air. I mean, they literally have taken out my internet here twice in the last few days, just playing ping, ping, ping all during the evening. And then 8 minutes after the hour, a couple nights ago when I was trying to introduce Grant Cameron to discuss Hillary Clinton's role in what seems to be an impending disclosure something, they cut the feed. And we had no internet for 20-some minutes, and then they put it back on, and I knew if I tried to redo the show, they would just turn it off. So it's now becoming clear to more people than just me that we are under attack. So we're taking appropriate steps. They will cost money. They will cost time. But this show will become what it was designed to be, which is a conveyor of information on things that normally they just don't get talked about. Okay. We had a very tragic story this evening as we were getting ready. Muhammad Ali has died. Now, it turns out that we have some remarkable insights into Muhammad Ali as the person that I wanted to talk about this evening, through our guest. Uri Geller apparently worked with Ali many years ago, and that's an extraordinary story we're going to get into in the next few minutes. The other piece of news, that's, by the way, link number one, a Radio with Pictures. If you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, click on Radio with Pictures, that takes you to tonight's guest page. Click on item number one, and that's how the sports world is reacting tonight to the news of a great man's death. Item number two, another great man, Elon Musk. We've discussed Elon on this show many, many times, and we're making overtures through various conduits and sources to get him on the show. It's going to happen. It will happen. I can't tell you when, but it's going to happen because I know things about Isaac Asimov. He doesn't, and he wants to know. So the thing that's so intriguing in line with our not being able to run with the show with Cynthia last night is that Elon Musk believes we are probably characters in some advanced civilization's video game. Let me repeat that. He thinks, Elon Musk thinks, this incredible robber baron type pioneer who's creating a whole space program all by himself, he thinks we could be part of some incredible super genius kids video game in the far distant future in terms of our timeline. Of course, our timeline would all be made up then. And I mean, it's such an extraordinarily interesting idea, and we've discussed it from different points of view, and I'm going to talk about that with Uri tonight. So we're going to take a break, 3 minutes. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and when we come back, we will be talking with Uri Geller. We shall return. On. And we are back on the other side of midnight. And all the way across the pond and a bit further, across the Mediterranean, Tonight we have the great honor and the great pleasure to have with us Uri Geller. Let me give you a couple of background notes and then we'll swing right into this morning. Uri was born in Israel in December of 1946. His parents were of Hungarian and Austrian descent, and he is distantly related on his mother's side to, wait for it, Sigmund Freud. At the age of four, he had a mysterious encounter with a sphere of light while in a garden near his home. A retired Israeli Air Force officer who was an eyewitness to this encounter validated this mystifying event decades later. In 1969, he began to demonstrate his powers of telepathy and psychokinesis to small audiences, but by the end of 1971, he was a household name throughout Israel, thanks to his numerous stage appearances, and he was given a huge boost by then-Prime Minister Golda Meir when asked on a national radio program what she predicted for the future of Israel. She replied, "Don't ask me, ask Uri Geller." Good morning, Uri, and welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Hey, good morning to you and to all your listeners. And yes, I'm in Israel, and I'm in a tiny little amazing, mystical, magical place called Old Jaffa. If you all Google Old Jaffa and you click on images, you will see how beautiful this place is. It's around 6,000 years old.
Oh, my gosh.
And yeah, and my apartment overlooks the promenade of Tel Aviv. I'm looking over a Russian church. I can see a mosque in the background. And, of course, the Mediterranean Sea spread just under our window. The apartment is among palm trees, beautiful red flowers. It's just an amazing place. And Hannah, my wife, and I decided to come back to our homeland after living 46 years outside the borders of Israel. So we lived 10 years in New York and then 34 years in England. And we love it here. We are just energized and empowered by the energy of the people and the land.
Well, it sounds to me like you've kind of come home, and it's really interesting that you're there, because that particular part of this planet, the real estate you're sitting on right now, Uri, I think is going to become incredibly important in the next few years, if not even sooner. Is that kind of why you're there?
Well, look, my contacts and my ties with certain bodies, individuals, certainly played a part in me coming back. But as you know, the whole Middle East is flared up right now, and unfortunately, there are hundreds of thousands of people being killed in the name of religion, and it is a very, very tough phase that we are going through. This is not happening only in the Middle East, but worldwide. And terrorism must be stamped out and eradicated. Otherwise, you know, you are going to stand, Richard, in lines in airports for 4 hours before they allow you to board. This is just one example.
Yeah. No, this you know, there used to be an old movie from the 1930s called Of Things to Come. And it was Raymond Massey was the star of it, I think. I saw it first when I was visiting in Washington, D.C., of all places. We can't go on this way. So one of the things I wanted to talk to you tonight about is, what do we do to make it different? You have a talent. It's been attested to me, my colleagues at SRI. We almost crossed paths at SRI many years ago. So I didn't want to argue about your talent. I wanted to talk tonight about how that talent and that ability and this physics and the technology lurking behind it can actually help people, can help the plight of this world, because we're on a very downward spiral unless we change the game.
That is true, Richard. But since you did bring in my talents, you know, let's be open about it. I'm hugely controversial. There are those who believe. Obviously, my fans worldwide, scientists who tested me, who've seen it with their own eyes under laboratory control conditions. And then there are the skeptics. They are basically a tiny minority. They have helped my career by publicizing my name. So to all the skeptics, I really ought to send them hundreds of bouquets of flowers for creating the legend or creating the longevity of Uri Geller. So that's the end of the skeptics. We won't talk about them anymore.
Well, we don't need to, because we're basically, where we're going, we don't need skeptics, okay?
Exactly.
But we do need evidence. So I want to return to those thrilling days of yesteryear, a famous phrase of mine. Actually, I didn't coin it. It's from the Lone Ranger. Remember the Lone Ranger?
I do remember, and I also remember Raymond Massey. So I'm in the
So you do know group. Raymond. He was dressed. Remember, he was dressed in those black spacesuits, and they basically was.
Yes.
It was Wings Over the World.
Didn't Raymond Massey also play a UFO film where a UFO lands? To the best of my recollection, but he was a great actor, and very few people remember his name.
Oh, he was incredibly versatile and talented. Incredible. Remember, he played Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln. He was one of the first Lincolns, yes. Anyway, so let's return to that childhood moment. You were in the garden, you were outside, and you met something or someone. What do you remember of that, and what did it do to the rest of your life and our lives?
Okay, from my window right now, I can kind of gaze over the place where it happened, although it's about three kilometers from here. I can see the whole Tel Aviv in front of me. I was about 5 years old, and opposite our apartment, which was on the corner of Rothschild Boulevard in Tel Aviv, the street was called Bezalel Yafe, and our apartment number was 13. There was a huge Arabic garden with a very thick and tall rusted iron fence around it. Right now there is obviously a bank on that piece of ground. A huge, high-rise bank.
One of them.
Anyhow, I found an opening through the iron gate and fence.
Oh.
So I used to sneak in and play there alone, actually with a little bullet head that my father brought back from his army times. And I used to pretend that I'm an astronaut and that I am in that bullet head, a little copper shining bullet head. Flying through the universe.
Wow.
I had fantastic imagination.
So you had celestial and etheric predilections even then?
I believe so. I used to draw, paint the capsules where I would be sitting as an astronaut and so on. But one day, I heard kittens cry. And obviously, as a little child, I looked for them. And then suddenly, the most amazing phenomenon, call it whatever you want to call it, happened in front of my eyes. I suddenly saw a sphere materializing in front of me. It was, I would say, it would be 2.5-3 meters in diameter.
Wow.
It was shining, glowing, and pulsating.
Do you remember Schwarzenegger's film, The Terminator, the first one?
Yes.
Remember
when
he appeared in the sphere? It sounds exactly like that kind of sphere.
Well, it was that kind of a sphere, and it was pulsating. And as a child, I just accepted it, but I was amazed because I've never seen anything like that before. To make a long story short, I don't really know how long I stared at this object, but the next thing I remember was almost a powerful jolt, like a laser beam type of a ray emanated out of this sphere, hit my forehead. I felt its strength, and it pushed me into the grass. Now, I don't know how long I lay there, but then I jumped up and I ran towards my apartment building to tell my mother of this, call it, encounter. Mm. She didn't believe me. She thought I was either dreaming it, I dreamt it, or I was making it up. Now, I lived with this story for years, for decades, until 10 years ago.
You mean the only person you told was your mom, and she said, come on, you're making it up.
No. I wrote about it in my book.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely. I was very open, and I was attacked, obviously, because people thought, come on, what is he trying to tell us that he's met a UFO? But I could not bury such a story, such a real happening, because it was so tangible. It was real.
So when did you go public with this?
Oh, when I wrote my first book. When Andrea Puharich, who was my mentor
right,
in 1970, 71, 72, who took me to America and introduced me to Captain Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut, he knew all about it. And then I wrote my first book, My Story. By the way, My Story and all my other books are available on my website to read free of charge. So I'm not selling any books. All my material is available free, totally free, on my website, which is urigeller.com.
And we have them linked by your bio on your page tonight.
Great. So in the book, I came out with it, I wrote about it, but no one else was there as a witness until 10 years ago. There was a documentary about me being broadcast in Israel by the BBC, in which I was telling this amazing phenomenon. And I got an email from a retired Air Force officer telling me, Uri, I have seen that sphere.
U.S. or Israeli?
No, Israeli Air Force.
Okay.
Because I was a young soldier, I was walking in Rothschild Boulevard, corner of Bezalel Yaffe, where I saw a little boy in this huge garden, and I saw this sphere. And then I saw the little boy running out of the garden towards his apartment building, and the sphere followed you. That's what he said in his email.
Ah.
And then, in a way, it exploded on the facade of the building, our apartment building in which I entered, and it left a darkened residue.
Wow.
Now, when I read this email, you can imagine I jumped on the
phone. Oh, the hairs ran up on the back of your neck.
It was a validation.
My God,
where,
that's astonishing.
You know, it was only my word to be believed. But then I met the man, Abrahami, and he told me the story, and I filmed him telling the story because it was so important for me to validate that, hey, I wasn't dreaming, and of course I wasn't making it up.
Wow.
Now, very soon after that, and I don't know if it's anything, if there is a link or a connection, but very soon after that, I was eating soup, and as I was lifting the spoon towards my mouth, it started bending and it broke. And that was it. That breaking of the spoon gave me the idea how to use this ability to climb out of the poverty we were living in.
Ah. So, decades later, I mean, this obviously you're thinking that there was some kind of latent ability in you that this encounter raised or put in motion that eventually kind of visualized when you had other things in your life happen that made all those dots come together.
Yes, I then started sharpening my psychokinetic abilities, my telepathic abilities, because they were kind of all in the same arena. I exercised it in school, demonstrated it to pupils and teachers and my mother's friends, and then I kind of brought it under control. I could bend the spoon at will, whenever someone asked me to. Now, of course, already then, I touched upon something that we all know today. It's called the secret. I touched upon something called the law of attraction. I believed in myself. I was a positive thinker. And because I was I had such great imagination, I used to imagine myself being successful, breaking into the world with this phenomenon, with my talents and abilities. So my parents divorced. I was 11 years old when my mother took me to Cyprus, where she married a Hungarian man living in Nicosia. This individual had a tiny little hotel, 14 rooms, Unfortunately, he died from a heart attack. So my mother and myself, we stayed running the hotel. I went to, at the same time, to Terra Santa College, which was a Catholic school. Being Jewish, it was a kind of a culture shock for me. And anyhow, the Israeli Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, found out that we owned this hotel, and we are Israelis. So they changed the hotel into an Israeli Mossad safe house. we didn't know, of course, but wow. Israelis started coming in, checking under, names like there were teachers, archaeologists, architects. Obviously, my mother didn't know, but I knew. I used my telepathy on one of them. His name was Yoav Shaham. And I told him, Yoav, you're an Israeli spy, aren't you?
You were, what, 11?
I was 11, 12. He freaked out. And he just didn't know how I knew. And then he made me, at the age of 12 or 13, I myself became a mini kind of subliminal spy by him giving me instructions that he will be sending top secret letters from Arabic countries like Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. And my task was that when these letters arrive to our little hotel under his name for him, I would sit on my bicycle and cycle them over to the Israeli consulate and hand them to the Israeli consul. So that was my first kind of experience working for, in a way, for the Israeli Mossad.
So did he believe you had talents?
Absolutely. He okay. not only believed, but he instructed me. He told me, look, Uri, when you will be 18, you must go back to Israel. You must join the paratroopers. You must go to officer school and then find me.
Wow.
Those were his words.
Wow.
Find me. Now, when a 13, 14-year-old hears these words, you can imagine.
I just want to get straight. So then he gave you this task, which didn't involve any talents. Basically, to give you training and to watch you and kind of be a mentor until you were old enough to join the service?
No, he went back to Israel. He just stayed spying like a year and a half or two.
Ah, okay.
But before he went back, he told me, I'm going to meet you in Israel and do this. Go to the paratroopers, become an officer, and then find me, and then I'll get you into the Mossad. So I was so excited being a child.
Of course.
You can imagine, you know, the James Bond
and an adult paid attention and took you seriously.
Exactly. You said it, Richard, that's very clever, the right way. Someone believed in these talents and skills that I had.
And someone you looked up to and admired and visualized
yes.
yourself as this person. It was the perfect role model. How do you think he got you? What do you think in his background made him say, wait a minute, this kid just has a talent?
Well, because when I bent a key for him, he freaked out. You, in my kitchen, in the little hotel, Pension Ritz, it was called, I bent a key for him, and that freaked him out, and then that's it. He said, you've got talents, we can use them.
Wow.
But I was only 13 at the time. But to make, again, a long, long story short, I did exactly what he said. We went back to Israel, and mind you, while we were living in Cyprus, there was a major civil war going on. The Greeks were killing the British,
yep.
the Turkish were killing the Greeks, and I've seen bloodshed, I've seen bodies blown up, I've been in curfews, I've seen bombings, I've seen brains, you know, splashed on the pavement. So I've gone through a very tough time being a teenager, seeing the death of dozens and dozens of people.
And you felt this was something you could do to get back, you know, to do something.
Well, yeah, you know, when a teenager sees such a horrendous death occurrence every week, week after week, you can imagine. I know this is sounds a little morbid, but when I attended the American school in Larnaca, there was a hospital right by the fence of the school, and the morgue was right behind the fence. Mm. And we as children, we used to see these bodies of blown up people being wheeled into the morgue, and we watched the blood oozing out of the off the marble slabs in the morgue. It was just so incredibly mind shattering.
So in a sense, your childhood was stolen from you.
No, I wouldn't say that. I think it was you know, it's not the right word, enriched, but I definitely learned about life after death, about the soul, about human energy, about killing other people, and so on. But I go back to Israel, I join the paratroopers, I go to officer school, and in the middle of the officer school, I read a tragic report, and the headline says, Yoav Shaham, which was his name, was killed last night in a raid in Samoa. It was a raid somewhere in...
Anyhow, so, sorry.
So that shattered my dream.
Hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. Let's pick it up right there when we come back. We got a three-minute break here. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Uri Geller, who I wanted to talk to for so long about so many things. Obviously, we're not going to be able to cram everything into a couple of hours, so we'll have him back. And then I'll be ready to actually measure some things. Anyway, you're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return. And welcome back to the other side of midnight. Sorry, we had some kind of a technical hiccup there. I think it's all been resolved. All these little hiccups. Anyway, Uri, pick up the story where you are, because you had just learned that your mentor to be had been killed on an Israeli raid, apparently a terrorist raid or something, right?
Yes, and that shattered my dream of ever becoming a Mossad spy or an agent. And then I went into, I was still broke. My mother was working very hard as a waitress and a seamstress. And I had to activate again my powers, because my skills, my talents, because I couldn't see myself doing just an ordinary job. And then as you read in my bio, I used to ride around with the beautiful models, and one day a male model didn't show up and I took his place, and suddenly I became a very wanted male model in Israel.
Wow.
And then I thought to myself, how long am I going to do this? And I did exactly the same as I did to Yoav one day to a photographer during a shoot. I think it was for a towel. I bent a key, his house key. And that obviously, again, astonished and freaked him out. And he said nobody will believe him. And he invited me to a house party in which I demonstrated my skills. And I was astonished because I couldn't believe how at all people were from rather trivial demonstrations of key bending, spoon bending, mind reading, fixing broken clocks and watches. And these parties became more and more prestigious, from photographers to lawyers, from lawyers to judges, from judges to generals. And then one day, Golda Meir was there, the Prime Minister of Israel. And I said to myself, this is my chance. I walked over to her. I gave her a piece of paper and a marker. There were no Sharpies at that time. And I told her, go to the toilet, go and shut the door and draw something, secret drawing. Come out, hold it tight so nobody will see it, and I'll read your mind. And she did that. She said, nobody can read my mind, but she went to the toilet. I think, Richard, I'm the only person in the world that ever sent a prime minister to the tournament. <laughs> <laughs> A
well-practiced line. Kudos, gentlemen. Yeah. Kudos. Okay.
And I read her mind when she came out. I never forget the drawing. It was a Star of David. And the next day...
Let me ask you, Ari. How come you didn't wind up in prison as an experiment of the Israeli state to find out how the hell you're doing this and how they could turn it into a defense? I'm serious. I'm very serious.
Well, wait until I tell you the whole story. So then the next day was the beginning of my career because she was being interviewed on Israeli radio.
Oh, yeah. That's when she said
that. And they asked her, Golda, the presenter, asked her to predict the future of Israel. And she... without hesitation, she said, oh, don't ask me. You should ask Uri Geller. And that was it. In my tiny apartment started ringing.
Off the hook. How could, that is such a nodal point, as we call it around here. Obviously, your life was never the same.
No, because managers and entrepreneurs started calling me, asking me if I can do this demonstration that I'm doing in parties. On big stages in front of 5,000 people. Mm-hmm. And because all I cared was about money and fame and fortune at that time, you know, I was on an ego trip. I said, yeah, of course I can. And then in no time...
Yuri, how did it feel to be a young Adonis? Literally with the powers of what some people would call the gods. I mean, no wonder it went to your head.
It went to my head in a negative way, and I'll tell you all about it because it followed me in New York and so on. But it went to my head because suddenly I was the most famous individual in Israel. I was not a singer, and I was not an actor. I was not a politician. I was not an army. I was a kind of an unusually unique, freaky phenomenon that people couldn't know how to handle.
You were a huge national security threat to every damn nation on the planet.
On the contrary, in Israel, they looked at it upon as very important. What I failed to tell you, and I have to bring this up, no matter how tough it's going to be, maybe for your listeners, but I fought in the Six-Day War. That's before my modeling time. And in the war, I was wounded. But before I was wounded... I was fighting in Jerusalem, and suddenly a young Jordanian soldier jumps out from behind a rock, and he's about to shoot me. He holds his machine gun, and I hold my Uzi, my machine gun. And I looked him in the eye, Richard, and my whole life rolled in my mind in front of me in a split second, millisecond. And then I snapped out of it, and I realized that whoever presses the trigger first will survive. And I was faster than him, and I killed him. I shot him. I killed him 2.5 meters away from me. And my first reaction is what I saw in American films, how you tear off the diskette around the neck. So I tore open his shirt, and that young Jordanian is in my mind, in my soul now. I know he's almost like my brother. And I do have reoccurring nightmares because this post-traumatic syndrome doesn't ebb away. But I have to bring this in because when Israeli intelligence services ask me whether I can help them, and we are talking about people like Moshe Dayan, Arik Sharon, these names are mega names of Israel. I met the Aharon Yariv, who was the head of the intelligence service. There's a vacuum which I cannot talk about. And that is very interesting because just recently the BBC exposed me as a spy. And they came out with a documentary called The Secret Life of Uri Geller.
Was it accurate?
It is actually on my website.
Is it accurate?
And absolutely accurate. Okay. And then Jonathan Margolis, a very prestigious and credible writer in England who writes for The Guardian in the Financial Times.
Was this the Horizon? Was this the Horizon series, the BBC Horizon series?
No, no, no. This was just a one-off.
Because I have a very good friend in England, Graham Hancock, who was viciously eviscerated by the BBC Horizon people.
Yeah, the Horizon people also did something debunking about me. But this is a very important documentary because it was directed by a Oscar-winning director. And as we all know, Muhammad Ali passed away just a few hours ago. Vikram Jayanti, who did my documentary called The Secret Life of Uri Geller, also did a very famous documentary about Muhammad Ali, for which he won an Oscar. So I urge you all to watch The Secret Life of Uri Geller on my website and get the book. The book is also fascinating, and it reveals from other sources rather than me the work I did for intelligence services, not only in Israel, but for the CIA and around the world.
So they did understand that you had something special. By the way, if people go to theothersideofmidnight.com and click on Radio with Pictures, scan down to Uri's name, you'll find The Secret Life of Uri Geller as the first link. That's the documentary, the BBC doc. Link number two is Dr. Hal Puthoff and laser physicist Russell Targ talking about Uri's secret CIA tests at SRI. The third link is Uri and Michael Jackson, and there's some pictures there. Then there's a picture of you with John Lennon. There's a picture of The Psychic and the Rabbit, which is a fascinating book, with a foreword by Deepak Chopra. So there's a lot of stuff to read and to peruse. Let's go back to where we were in the story. So they basically said, Uri, you've got talent. Let's take this big time. And did that become the cover for your, shall we say, extracurricular activities?
Yeah, what happened is basically I had double life. Then in 1972...
You were James Bond!
With
an Israeli accent!
The Mossad made a deal with the CIA to test me in Palo Alto and Stanford Research Institute. And that's why I was allowed to leave Israel in 1972. But my cover was my show business life. The Uri Geller on Merv Griffin and Johnny Carson and the publicity, you know, especially when I went on Johnny Carson, where he humiliated me for 22 minutes. The spoon that bent wasn't enough, and he was a skeptic, and I thought that was the end of my show business career. But that show, Johnny Carson, was the show that revealed to me that there is no such thing as bad publicity as long as they spell your name correctly.
Going back to P.T. Barnum, who I think said that first.
And he was right, because no matter how much the skeptics tried to debunk me, Uri Geller, they just made me more and more famous, more and more controversial, more and more interesting, and people were curious about this young guy from Israel who bends spoons with the power of his mind.
Okay, so let me ask, which came first? Did they envelop you in the agencies, the alphabet agencies as we call them over here, first, or did they have you tested at SRI first to make sure that you really could do what you thought you could do?
Well, the first was the Mossad work, obviously, without any control conditions. They couldn't care less. They said, look, do this, get us this information. We don't care how you get it. But for the CIA, they wanted to know the mechanics. They wanted to know the know-how. How is the mind? How does the mind work? How does it obtain it? And indirectly, I believe that I set up, indirectly, the remote viewing, agency, or call it the remote viewing program for the CIA, because it was me and Ingo Swann who were being tested at Stanford by Harold Puthoff and Russell Targ, who I owe, these three people, Russell Targ, Hal Puthoff, and Captain Edgar Mitchell, who unfortunately passed away a few months ago.
I know.
They made my career because they stuck their necks out for me. they said Uri Geller is real, no matter
now,
what.
Did you meet Ed Mitchell? Because I knew Ed for many, many years. Did you meet him before he went to the moon? Were you part of that ensemble that led him to his experiments and then to come back and found Noetics, etc.?
No, I met him after because he was instrumental in luring me out of Israel by sending me a signed picture saying,
bait.
My dear. And when I got that picture, I freaked out getting a picture from an astronaut.
Well, you knew about his great ESP experiment halfway between the Earth and the Moon, right?
Everyone knew about it because it was all over the media.
Yep.
And he also in Israel, it was walking on the moon is something that is transmitted to 7 billion people.
Well, almost.
So when I left in 1972 straight to Stanford, I didn't want to be a guinea pig. I wanted show business. I wanted, I did want the Merv Griffins and the Mike Wallace and all those shows.
Yes, you were everywhere. Talk about a household name.
Everywhere.
You had a household name to the point where I had a very good friend in Berkeley, when I lived in Berkeley, and next to her apartment house there was the Institute for the Study of Consciousness or something like that.
Noetic Science.
No. That's across the bay. This is in Berkeley.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. This was set up by Ruth and what was his name? I can't remember his name. He was a big he was a big engineer at Bell Helicopters. Anyway, he was into consciousness, so he was very much into your work. She woke up one night and looked out the window, and all the people in the Institute were sitting around in a circle, and she could look down on the windows from her apartment house, and they were all bending spoons, chanting in unison, to where the whole neighborhood woke up.
Well, you know what? I brought spoon bending into world culture, and I'm saying this shamelessly.
No question.
You see movies like The Matrix with Keanu Reeves learning how to bend a spoon by a child. I'm honored that
that's you.
It
looks like you.
Yep. George Clooney played me in a movie, The Men Who Stared at Goats.
Mm-hmm.
Robert De Niro played me just 2 years ago in a movie called Red Lights. People like Johnny Cash, Kenny Rogers sang about spoon bending. So it's amazing, and I think that is the phenomenon, how I managed to bring spoon bending into world culture. And, just yesterday I saw an article from some university in America, if I Google it, I'll find it, where doctors are learning how to bend spoons. And this is just a week ago. So,
why are they learning?
So overall,
doctors,
looking at,
medical doctors are learning how to bend spoons? Why?
If you just Google now.
I'll email it to you.
I was amazed that it's open for doctors, medical doctors are learning how to bend spoons. I'll email it to you in a moment. But what this shows to me, Richard, is that skeptics failed miserably in trying to debunk different phenomena, so from UFOs to Bigfoot. And those are legends, and they will always stay alive. Nothing can destroy that. And when I started doing my secret work worldwide, I loved it because it was, from one side, I was a showman, I was an entertainer, and from the other side, I did some very, very serious, secretive stuff.
Mm, which you can't tell us about.
Well, that's why I'd like you to watch The Secret Life of Uri Geller and read the book, because there are CIA agents. There is Keith Green, who was in Langley, Virginia. He tested me once over the phone. Russell Targ or Hamp would have told him, this guy, Uri Geller, can read minds. And Keith Green, or Keith, said, no, he can't. And this is 3,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
He's in Langley, and we are in California. And, there were no cellular phones, and there were no mobile phones. There was no internet, nothing.
It was primitive.
And then he puts me on the line with him, and he says to me, and this is a CIA agent, and he says, Uri, I'm holding something in my hand. And I said, you're holding a book and there's a picture that looks like scrambled eggs, but over the page in very big and thick black letters, I can see the word architectural. He freaked out. I think he was holding Grey's Anatomy.
Oh.
The page was open to the brain, which looked like a scrambled egg.
Like scrambled egg, yes.
But above it, he, with his handwriting, wrote architectural.
Oh, so you picked out his own, and of course it freaked him out. So
then
what happened?
It freaked him out. I mean, we're talking about, I'm in California, he's on the other side of the United States, and I tell him what's on his page. So that to him was a validation, and he was instrumental in moving the American Defense Department, I would say certain agencies, in taking this talent very seriously.
Wow. Well, they've done various versions, and someday somebody's going to do the big movie of your life, because, you know, it's... Do you, going back to that childhood experience, that five-year-old who met the whatever that was, the being, do you think that either reconnected you with a mission you have here, or it gave you a mission?
You know, Richard, I have to be careful when I go into this kind of explanation, because I've never seen an alien, but I've seen UFOs. I don't know if it was a being. I don't know what it was. I know inside my heart I do feel that it had a connection to my abilities. No doubt. Of course, no doubt. Whether I got a mission or a subliminal instruction, I don't know. So the answer is I don't know. But I know one thing, that going around the world, I managed... And again, I'm saying this not to show off or to brag or to boast, but I'm saying that I've done some very major things that I will never be able to talk about. And that's some things like, for instance, when the Americans asked me to help them convince the Russians to sign the Nuclear Arms Reduction Treaty. Mm-hmm. And I was taken to Geneva by Senator Claiborne Pell, who was the head of the American Foreign Relations Committee.
A very interesting guy, Claiborne Pell. A very interesting guy.
Al Gore was with us. The CIA head, the head of the CIA was there, and I had to get close to Yuli Voronsov, the Russian head of the nuclear arms negotiator, and I bombarded his mind to sign, and they signed. And obviously I can't take full credit, but I was instrumental in making that happen.
Well, this raises a really impressive point, because if you can do that, or if you're riding up in an elevator, I'm going to create a fake scenario here. You're riding up in an elevator with Putin, and your friends say, just kind of find out what he's up to this afternoon. If you could do that, and I think given what we know about your talents, you can, then how come, again, you're still walking around? You're a walking national security nightmare for a whole bunch of people.
Because I attach it to my entertainment. That's my inbuilt safety device. The skeptics are my inbuilt safety device. And that is it.
So you mean the ultimate security you're saying is the fact that in the real world, quote, most of the people who count don't believe you?
No, they believe, but they think I'm an entertainer.
No, but they don't believe you have that talent.
I guess so, and I hope it stays that way. Because like you said, and you said it very cleverly, Richard, I see you have a very deep depth of understanding, the cloak and dagger, the secretive world, the dark, the going deep, dark side of business. And you're right. If everybody believed that I could influence Putin or anyone else, I guess I wouldn't be walking around today very freely. I would have bodyguards and so on. But that's why I balance my existence and my work in a very interesting way, that nobody really knows, is it real or is it not? And that's the way I like it.
You know what's so freaky, Yuri? You are the living example of a scenario I laid out for an editor of mine. His name was Ben Bova. He's an engineer. He's still around. I'm going to talk to him on the show in a few months or so. He was the editor of Analog Magazine back in the 1960s and 70s and 80s. And Analog was the heir to the famous Astounding Science Fiction magazine created by John Campbell, who gave us the huge greats, Arthur Clarke and Isaac
but
Asimov.
But he also was the editor of Omni magazine.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Well, then you know Ben. Okay, well, I'm in a cab with Ben and his secretary, and we're heading up Fifth Avenue to go to some conference. And we got talking about magic, and your name came up. This is going to be kind of freaky. And I used you as an example of someone who, if they had a talent and they did not want to be have the fate of the green monkey. You know the story of the green monkey, right?
Amazing.
So I said to him, what if Yuri or people like him would mask their talent for survival under showmanship to mask the fact they really can do it? And he almost never talked to me again. He was so freaked out and so angry that I would even bring that up. It was kind of, you know, it was in 1970, so what can I say?
But, you know, scientists, also Arthur C. Clarke believed in the beginning. I have met him many times. And I bent his house key. Yep. And then...
That's almost as bad as bending his ego. Arthur and I went
exactly,
way back.
Absolutely. And then other scientists convinced him that this was not real and it was all to do with chemicals and sleight of hand. And he, in a way, changed his mind later on. And
well, you know, just to be honest, Yuri, Arthur was not totally with us toward the end. So he had some medical issues that we won't, you know, dwell on. But
really,
his initial impressions, both of your work and actually of my work, were much more stable before he got to where he was influenced by people who, frankly, wanted to change his mind on certain key things.
Well, you know that when you have people like Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff and Keith Green, those are the people you have to admire and respect because they have stuck their necks, as I said before, and they adhered to their belief system. Other scientists are afraid because it's all to do with their position, with the grants that they are afraid that might be stopped. And although some scientists who are physicists like Brian, you know, there are Nobel Prize physicists, Brian Josephson, who also believes in the power of the mind, and he's a Nobel Prize physicist. There are only very few of these scientists that will go to believing to the rest of their lives. And people who are mainly science writers, scientists, physicists, don't want to even touch this because they're afraid of ridicule. Anyhow,
well,
let me
see,
just
that,
go back to your...
Ridicule is the man. We're at the top of the hour, so let's hold it there. I want to come back. I want to talk about the experiments at SRI because
okay.
I have some fond memories of my connections with SRI. I want to see if they dealt with your unbelievable science like they dealt with my unbelievable science. You're on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Yuri Geller. Yes, the Yuri Geller. Who may or may not be able to do what he's doing because that is keeping him alive, and we're going to keep it exactly that way. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back with my guest this morning, Yuri Geller. Yuri, how did you wind up being taken to SRI? What were the actual steps, and were they initially very skeptical, or did they actually kind of believe their friends?
I will tell you in a moment, but I just want to jump back. Before the break, you were talking about the scientist who you drove in the car, and it was hard to convince him.
Oh, Ben Bova. Yeah, he was.
And again, my respect to Muhammad Ali. I think it was the three people who were, and unfortunately now there are only two, that were on the cover of Marvel Comics' Daredevil. It was Muhammad Ali, it was me, and it was, what's his name, Jimmy Chang, the guy who does the judo, what's his name, the famous movie actor.
Bruce Lee.
Bruce Lee. And on the cover of Daredevil, this is a comic going back to, I think, 1976.
I think it was one of Jack Kirby's creations.
Yep, you see me and Daredevil, and it's the enemy shouts mind waves, and he's fierce on think tank, and it says a city in danger, and only one man can help, the most shocking guest star of all, the incomparable Uri Geller. So when I got on the cover of Daredevil comic, to me, that was a seal of approval that indeed I managed somehow to instill the phenomenon of spoon bending into American culture.
Mm.
Now, going back to how I got, no, the scientists at SRI were not skeptical at all. Because they already knew information from Mossad, from the Israeli Secret Service. They have received information from an Israeli scientist who saw me perform at the Technion. The Technion is a huge think tank in Haifa.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow they found out from other sources about my work here in Israel. But they wanted to capture the essence, the energy of the work. What makes it happen?
Oh, my gosh.
And that's when...
So they wanted to replicate your talent, but in other people or in robots?
Yeah,
or
they wanted to see if they could create departments that dealt with psychic stuff. They were also, remember, they were also very concerned about Russian psychics doing stuff for them, for the KGB.
Well, in this time frame, the Russians were light years ahead in terms of telekinesis and other psychometry and other kinds of psi experiments.
Exactly, and they knew that. This is why they said they were worried about psychical research that was going on in Russia, and they said, get Uri Geller here. Get this guy from Israel here. So they sent him under.
You know, you must really have been on cloud, forget 9, 29. You were about, what, 29, right? And you were the cat's meow. You were in demand, and you were doing things that most people can't do. And you were having a ball, and obviously the girls, all the Bond girls. I mean, so you get to SRI, and what do they want you to do?
Yeah, but hold on. They sent first Andrea Puharich, a medical doctor with ties to the CIA, to Israel.
Who has a very bizarre history.
To test me here in Israel, just to make sure that they're bringing the real deal to America.
Yeah, Puharich has he has an extraordinarily weird story his own, you know.
Yeah, and he freaked out again. He was astonished because he put me under his own laboratory control conditions here in a little town next to Tel Aviv called Herzliya. And he saw it's real, and he said, you are coming back with me to America. And then I got the picture from Edgar Mitchell, and then I said, let's go, because my dreams were coming true. So when I landed in San Francisco, and they drove me to Palo Alto. I got to know Hal Puthoff and Russell Targ real well. They were amazing individuals. And then they subjected me to a long series of tests, which are on my website. It is a secret film called...
I'll tell you what, hold it there. We've got a couple of minutes of commercials, and then we shall be right back here on the other side of midnight, and we shall return. And we are back with my guest this morning, Uri Geller. And I'm getting some kind of a weird delay. I think maybe Skype is somehow looped into the board or something. If Carlos, you can check that. Anyway, I want to call everybody's attention to theothersideofmidnight.com. That's our homepage. Go to there. Go to Radio with Pictures. That will take you down to Uri's stuff. Emma's gotten an interesting set of images posted now. We've got Muhammad Ali and you As item number one, we have the link to the BBC documentary. Number two, there's you and Michael Jackson, and as I said earlier, John Lennon. And so let's start now with SRI, because the science of how this is measured, the fact that we're not talking about just your opinion, but there are people who have validated through technology and instrumentation and documentation that you actually can do the things that you claim to do, that's very important, I think, to get on the record.
Yes. When you say SRI, just to remind our listeners, SRI stands for Stanford Research Institute. And today it's Stanford University. But Stanford Research Institute was mainly financed by ARPA, Advanced Research Project Agency. That's a major, important, secretive arm of the American Defense Department. They have financed scientists who were testing many different things. Among them, the most important was psychic phenomenon. And they used me and other people to be their guinea pigs and to try to discover how this works. Is it a wave that the mind emits? Is it a frequency? Is it a vibration? Is it consciousness? They just simply didn't know. They knew that we could do it because I've done these tests. If you see the film, the SRI film is amazing. It's a half an hour of tests under laboratory controlled conditions at Stanford Research Institute. It's color, so although it was done in 1973, but it's quite astounding to see how many tests I was given to do, and I passed them all. The results were so astonishing that they were written up in Nature magazine. Nature magazine happens to be the most prestigious scientific magazine in the world. But I think that even up until to today, decades later, there is still no scientific explanation to how the mind works exactly. We've got now the scanning machines and the MRIs and the sophisticated topographical shots of our brains, etc., etc. But we still do not understand consciousness fully, reality, quantum mechanics, and quantum entanglement. And I think with these words, I kind of covered it all. And we all know that there is infinity, which means no end, nothing ever ends. That's why Albert Einstein in 1924 proved to the world with his very famous equation, E equals MC square, that everything is made from energy in the universe. Everything. The table, the phone I'm holding, you, me, and energy cannot be destroyed. So that's where one must ask, okay, if energy cannot be destroyed, what happens when we die? What happens to our soul? What happens to our energy? What happens to our spirit if it cannot be destroyed? So this is all one area of the mind, of consciousness, of reality, that science still doesn't understand fully. Now, 10,000 years from now, 50,000 years from now, 100,000 years from now, no doubt we will be able to teleport ourselves. We'll be able to dematerialize in one place and materialize in another place. We will be able to send our mind through space and time, travel through stars and so on. But it is a gradual movement towards that discovery. I'm just concerned on other things that might happen to us along the way. Natural catastrophes, global warmings. When I say natural catastrophes, I'm talking about major earthquakes, shifts of the core of our planet. I'm talking about outer space disasters like meteorites hitting us. I'm talking about the raging wars that are happening right as we speak. So we're really traveling through a major mess that we have to learn how to stop these major catastrophes. Like, for instance, if scientists do discover a meteorite or a comet heading towards planet Earth, how do we stop that? How do we avert that? How do we stop the earthquakes? Or how do we predict the coming of the big one? And how do we cure global warming? Those are the things that are much more important now than anything else. And I think you'll agree with me, Richard.
But Yuri, those are only, and I'm going to probably make you unhappy with saying this, those are only technical problems. We have technical solutions that can solve those. Our problem is will. People are so fragmented. People are so afraid and whipped into fear porn frenzy over the other. Look at Trump's idiotic proposal to ban Muslims from coming to the United States. Look at him wanting to build a wall. There is a tremendous psychic evilness kind of spreading over the globe like a black stain in Europe, in Africa, in the Far East, here. The worst of mankind is coming to the surface, and we need a consciousness revolution. We need a consciousness game changer, because the material threats we face are nothing compared to the psychic threats that we apparently are caving in under.
I absolutely agree with you, Richard. Every word that you said is massively and mammothly important. Everything that you just said, we need. But it's not easy to unite 7.2 billion people to think positive. It's not easy to convince world leaders to go the right path, and because we are dealing with things like the terrorism, like war, we are worried. Most of our security agencies worldwide are worried about a nuclear bomb in a suitcase. Just imagine the World Trade Center tragedy, the 11th of September, is just a small example. But can you imagine if a nuclear weapon explodes downtown LA or in Paris or London, and the terrorists have their hand on such material? Luckily, they don't quite know how to sustain it in a suitcase, but that's going to be next. Bacteriological warfare, viruses released. I mean, you know it. It's happening, and we are too busy. Governments are too busy and engaged in dealing with these things, and then we are kind of letting go of the very, very major, major threats that planet Earth and our civilization and population is facing.
In the work you did with the Mossad and then with the CIA, in terms of people wanting to somehow capture this in a bottle and copy it, clone it, so that they could be used in terms of national security, did you ever try to sit down with a map and look for terrorist cells, look for caches of weapons, look for bombs, look for weird radioactive things that shouldn't be where they are, that kind of thing? In other words, were you able ever to bring this under such control that it was repeatable, that you could be part of a defense against these problems?
I can't talk about that. You just entered the realm of something that I cannot talk about. What others say about me concerning these subjects and missions, etc., you know, that's okay, because it's not me talking, but I myself cannot talk about that field.
Okay. Next question then. Has anyone ever found others like you?
I do believe that there are teams of intuitives, people who are highly intuitive, that are being used for remote viewing missions, for lost planes with top secret information, which we already did for President Carter, and Carter was asked when he was lecturing once in a university. A student got up and asked him, President Carter, was there anything strange that happened during your presidency? And he said, oh, yeah, I remember there was a Russian plane that crashed in Zaire, and psychics found the plane for us.
Ah.
So already then he admitted that there was research and work by psychics or intuitives or remote viewers who delivered very important information for the American Defense Department.
Interesting. But there's been no real discussion of there's other people like Yuri Geller.
Well, there's no doubt in my mind that there are people like me, and maybe not a lot, but there are individuals who are working with certain agencies, but it's all deep black.
I can imagine. So in terms of these tests, in addition to the aptitude test, you know, you were doing various things at SRI. I want to get into that. Did anybody do any genetic testing to see if you, genetically, you, Yuri Geller, are somehow unique or you have characteristics that are similar to other people, either, you know, linked in terms of culture, in terms of race, in terms of genetic heritage, in terms of, you know, ancient Neanderthal ancestors, God knows what. But in other words, did they look to find out what made you, you?
They have in many universities and institutes and hospitals that they did research on me. They have attached electrodes to my head, and they try to map out my brain, especially in the University of in Japan, in Tokyo. They try to understand how the process of intuition works, consciousness. Of course, they did try, and they are still working at it. There are many universities around the world that are dealing with the human brain, the human mind. But there isn't any concrete data. There's nothing really that you can write about in scientific terms that, oh, we have discovered the source of telepathy. We know how extrasensory perception works. That has yet to come.
Okay, you've been at this now for decades, since at least, what, the 70s, 60s?
Yeah, since many decades since I was born, for sure.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, the question I'm going to ask now is, have you noticed changes in your ability? We have a physics model that says the physics is changing, and the prediction is that these kinds of things should be showing up more and more often because more and more people are getting in touch because of this changing background with their own capabilities in these areas. Have you noticed over decades, which is a long span of time, have you noticed changes?
I definitely believe that as I grow older, my skills and talents are becoming stronger. They're not, definitely not ebbing away. I thought they might be ebbing away with age, but they're not. It's unlike a singer who, let's take Frank Sinatra, definitely I believe, at least I believe, that there was a change in his voice since he was 20 into his 70s. It's a natural occurrence.
Sure.
Because there is wear and tear in the body, and, you know, things change physically. But with the mind, it seems to be growing. You see, remember, Richard, the last frontier is not space. The last frontier is the mind, because in the mind, there is also inner space. You can, one day, we will be able to travel into inner space and then discover universes there, cosmoses, different, you know, life forms like outer space. One day there will be a contact. One day there, you know, a UFO will land here. One day for sure we will find extraterrestrial life in outer space. Of course, no doubt. It's impossible. If we're talking about infinity, then just be rational. It's impossible that we are the only living creatures in the universe. If we are, then what a waste of space.
Yeah, because I want to now ask a question that kind of brings these two ends of this string together, cosmic string. You heard what I said at the top of the show about Elon Musk thinking that we're probably in a computer simulation.
Yes.
What do you think? I mean, you've had a life which is not normal. Most people on this planet, most of those 7 billion, can't do what you can do on command, on demand. And that must really be telling us something about reality. That's why I asked the question about, are there others like you that you're aware of? Had there been more numbers growing recently than earlier? Have your talents changed? You said they've gotten better. That's all consistent with the physics which is changing, or with a programmer, some kid like Trelane, who's getting better at his video game a la Elon Musk.
I think so, yes. Look, as time goes by, Richard, you know, we're advancing. Maybe in certain fields in bigger leaps, certain fields in smaller leaps, but no doubt we are getting there. We are advancing in technology. We are advancing in medicine. We are advancing in the know-how of understanding what makes us tick, what makes the universe work. NASA is constantly bringing in amazing information from outer space. So, yeah, the answer is that we are, and physically, also physically, Richard, we're, you know, we are changing. Let me tell you this, that I believe that maybe 10 million years from now, if planet Earth does survive, humans won't look like humans anymore. Mm. You know, we'll have bigger brains. We won't have to use our mouth because we'll be communicating telepathically. So physical changes will occur in our looks, and that is because we are advancing in time and we are getting closer to that creator, to the creator. I, Richard, happen to be a religious man, meaning I do believe in God, and I do believe in the power of prayer. I do believe in the power of love. I believe in the energy of God. God created us. I'm not a Darwinist. I don't believe we crawled out of the muck. Mm. We might even be extraterrestrials in nature. How do we know, or how do we not know, that maybe a UFO, an extraterrestrial vehicle, did crash on Earth 600,000-800,000 years ago? Mm-hmm. And we are star children. Mm-hmm. We poured out of those vehicles, of those UFOs, if you want to believe that, and we seeded planet Earth. We know very little. I mean, we don't even know the answer to a very fundamental and almost childish question. What came first, the chicken or the egg?
Yes, of course. Do you think that we are the first in terms of high-tech civilization on this planet?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So you don't think we have any hidden ancestry that's much more amazing than we have now?
Look, going back to ancestry, again, I am a very open-minded person. In a way, I slightly delve into conspiracy theories like you, too. We know that...
As a former member, or is it ever a former member of the Mossad? Of course you delve into conspiracy theories. Ah, duh.
You have. It's a part of the business. But, you know, you and I know that probably the ancient Egyptians derived knowledge from some higher source.
Exactly. The question is where?
How would they know about astronomy? How would the thousands of years ago, cavemen drew flying objects in the sky? So no doubt that there was knowledge bestowed upon us thousands of years ago.
Well, then you've answered the question. Somebody was here before us. Someone came and gave us something, either relatives or extraterrestrial aliens, but you just said that the knowledge base we have cannot be explained by the history we have to explain it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. No doubt that there was a higher intelligence, that's my belief system, that came and visited us, left us knowledge. Maybe most humans didn't know how to use that knowledge, but some did. And this is why we have relics found today.
Yes, and then the question, Yuri, is did they also implant certain genetic time capsules of which you are one?
Look, Richard, you and I cannot deny or cannot confirm that. We can't.
No,
even
we can't.
I can't.
But we at least need to think about it as a possibility, given that the universe is becoming so much more astonishing than we thought even like 5 years ago. Hey, hold it there. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest this morning, and we're about to go really cosmological here, is Uri Geller. We're probing beyond where someone has gone before for some time. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. And as this last show of the end of the week before next week, and boy, do we have some amazing shows for you next week, Joseph Farrell is coming on Tuesday morning. And then we're following that up with Wednesday morning, which is following the California primary, and God knows what's going to happen, but it won't be dull. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. And we are back on the other side of midnight. My guest this morning, Uri Geller. Uri, how did you wind up meeting Muhammad Ali?
Because I'm exactly now looking at my picture with him, which was put up by my webmaster just moments ago. And it was in New York when I lived in on 57th Street and First Avenue. A photographer told me to join him because he was going out to Muhammad Ali's training ground in New Jersey. In New Jersey. So, of course, you know, I mean, already then his name was one of the most famous names in the world. And what I discovered was a very interesting, charming, incredibly charismatic man who loved magic and mysticism. Hmm. And I bent a spoon for him, and he actually gave me a spoon. A signed spoon. I have a Cadillac that on its body I riveted about 3,000 spoons from very interesting people like Elvis Presley, John Lennon, Salvador Dali, Mandela, and Muhammad Ali. And so there are about 3,000 important spoons on this Cadillac, which has been displayed in many, many museums around the world. I also trained him. He wanted to know how he could use vibrations or his stare instilling fear into his opponents. And I remember I was in the ring with him. I have pictures with him in the ring in his training camp. So I had long sessions with him, teaching him how to use the power of the mind while he was fighting.
Wow. So he really was into the whole Sufi, if I can use this in my profession, I'll just assume that it works and I'll use it. I'll go with it.
I think he believed, you know, he loved magic. I mean, he loved, like, tricks. But he also believed, I know he believed in mind power because he told me that. And, you know, he spent
his whole rope-a-dope strategy was not just physical. It was psychological.
No doubt in my mind that he used that. I showed him how I use mine. And I told him, this is how you should activate the power of your mind. And, what an incredible individual he was. And obviously, wherever you open any television set now, or you switch on the radio, and the social media, they're just talking about how great he was.
Yeah, there's a great shot. I think we have the same shot from your site on our site and was able to get it put up tonight. There's a very young Muhammad Ali. Gosh, does he look young? And there's a very young Uri Geller. So you guys really hit it off.
Yeah, we did. We did. And he wasn't far away from me in New Jersey. It took me less than an hour to get there, I think. And, we lost the greatest. I said that on my Facebook. I said, yes, he was the greatest boxer of all time. He was also the most charismatic man I have ever met, the greatest showman. He loved magic and the mysterious. He was the most gifted, unique personality in sports history. Incredible life, astonishing achievements. And that's on my Facebook.
And he had character. Uri, he was a man first. Remember during Vietnam when he said no?
Yeah, I do remember that. Who doesn't?
I mean, he literally took his whole young life and threw it away because of principle. And fortunately, life returned the favor and said, no, you're a person we should exemplify.
Yeah, that is true. And, you know, no matter how controversial he was, everybody loved him. Am I right, Richard?
Yes, totally, totally. Well, because he had character. He was real. He didn't con you. He, you know, if you were an opponent, you know, sting like a butterfly, you know, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. But he was bigger than just his sport. He was a world class figure at a critical time in history.
Yes, I see comments on my Facebook, even from people who did not like boxing or don't like boxing. Here is one from a Michael Walton. He says, I hate boxing and any violent sports, but it is funny how boxers are often very nice people out of the ring. So, yeah, very, very interesting comments on my Facebook.
And, well, you know, there's that whole social thing that he became a role model for a whole generation of young black Americans who had no other way out of the ghetto, the inner city, than sports, being good at something. And he demonstrated, if you're good at something, you can make it. And he was such a beacon of being good in many dimensions. He was the classic role model.
Yes, and you know, I must say, touch upon another subject here. I don't really know if there was a connection to his Alzheimer or whatever he actually died from because of his boxing, because the many hits he got on his head, which shook up his brain.
Well, look at what's going on in the NFL. We know that does not do you any good.
Exactly. You're driving there. Exactly what I wanted to say. I am very, very much against sports that knock the brain. And
I mean, he was such a brilliant mind. If he had not conducted himself in that arena, what else could he have excelled in that would have allowed him to... I mean, he's not much older than we are. He shouldn't be dead.
5 years older than I am.
Yeah.
If he wouldn't have been a boxer, he would have been a great actor.
Yes.
No doubt in my mind.
Or a politician. He was a brilliant politician, Yuri. The way he handled the Vietnam thing and made people look by putting his character and himself on the line... You know, his word where his actions were, that kind of thing. He became a role model for more than just sport, for more than boxing.
Yes, I absolutely, again, agree with you. He could have been even the president, believe it or not. I don't know if technically that would have been allowed because of his controversial thing with the army, not being, yes, being. But... nevertheless, he's gone, and we go back to Albert Einstein's E equals MC square that proves that everything is made from energy and energy cannot be destroyed. Mm. His energy is alive and well. I am another believer in life after death. I believe in heaven. I believe in another dimension where we all go when we die. And he's there with the greatest. And I was asked many times about Michael Jackson. And I say to them, Michael is sitting up there with Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley, you know, John Lennon, and the greatest singers of the world.
Can you imagine those jam sessions? I mean, just unbelievable. Speaking of Michael Jackson, we got a picture of him on the website tonight. What was your relationship with Michael?
Michael was introduced to me by a man called Muhammad Al Fayed, who used to own Harrods, you know, the Harrods, famous Harrods.
Oh, the big super retail department store in London.
But he was also the father of Dodi, who died with Princess Diana in Paris in the Mercedes that crashed into the wall.
Right.
And I was visiting Mohammed one day. We're sitting outside in his garden, in his summer home in outside London. And suddenly Michael calls. Now, let's backtrack a few decades. I had a show at the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles. And when I finished my show, an usher, a girl, comes up to me. She was an usher,
And she tells me, Mr. Geller, do you know who sat right there? And I said, who? She says, Michael Jackson. We recognized him. He came in a disguise. And I freaked out. I said, what? Are you telling me that the Michael Jackson came to my show? And I was too late because he was gone. And that's when I knew that he was probably interested in spoon bending or telepathy or something like that.
Well, didn't he have an interest in? Wasn't he interested in magic?
There is a clip on television from a documentary called "When We Were Kings," and that's the same director, Vikram Jayanti, who directed The Secret Life of Uri Geller. So there you go, synchronicity.
Oh, wow, talk about synchronicity.
So when Michael left the house, I haven't heard of him for decades, and until that afternoon, sitting with Muhammad Al-Fayed, the phone rings, it's Michael, and Muhammad Al-Fayed tells Michael, you know who is sitting next to me? It's Uri Geller. Mm-hmm. And I actually heard Michael shriek out of the phone, Uri Geller!
Wow!
And he handed me the phone, and that was it. We became instantaneously friends on the phone, and then I flew to New York to meet him. I had a show in New York. And then, to make a long story short, I designed his last album, Invincible. If you have Invincible at home, and if you open the booklet, you will find my drawings there. He instructed me to secretly instill the names of his two children at that time, Prince and Paris. And I had to do it in tiny, tiny letters because I knew that if Sony will discover that I have secretly put Michael's children's names in my drawing, they might, blot it out
out. Yes.
But it's in there. They couldn't find it. But if you take a magnifying glass, you will definitely find the names. And then when I renewed my wedding vows with Hannah, my wife, he agreed to be our best man.
Hmm.
And he was my best man when we did our wedding.
Yuri, let me ask you a very serious question. Do you think he was murdered?
No, I don't think he was murdered. No.
You think it was a horrible,
I traveled these tough times with him through the media, so I saw what terrible and awful things the media said about him concerning children, and I wanted to know the truth. So one day he asked me to stop him from eating junk food. And I told him, look, Michael, I can do that only if I hypnotize you. And he said, really? Can you really do that? Hmm. I said, yes, because I learned hypnotism in Israel from a great hypnotist. And I hypnotized him. It was a dark studio. He went into deep trance. And under deep trance, I asked him, it was very, very unethical for me, and I admit it now.
Oh,
I did something highly unethical. I asked him, Michael, did you ever touch a child in an inappropriate manner? And he immediately answered, no, I would never do that. And then I asked him, why did you pay Jody Chandler $20 million, whatever it was? And then he said, I couldn't take it anymore. I had enough. So to me, Richard, that was a private validation that this man was totally and utterly innocent.
Well, that kind of squared with what I thought, watching the trials and watching the attack, because Jackson was speaking at a very deep level, and that's incredibly powerful. And on this planet, Yuri, you know there are folks that don't like that kind of power if it's not in their hands. And his whole return, his whole reincarnation tour that was going to kick off there in London, it had such potential. I just had the awful feeling that the taking him out was so his message of connection and peace and community and humanity could not achieve the heights it was going to achieve.
No, he died from what we all know. Unfortunately, certain doctors throughout his life prescribed him very hard medication. And if you get addicted to such medication, you're going to go downhill. That's what happened to him. And I just,
so it's a real Shakespearean tragedy. We have this incredible talent, and he does it to himself.
Yeah, but we go back to history, Elvis Presley. I mean, I can name you a dozen.
Well, look at Prince
singers,
the other day, and
actors.
He wasn't. Look at Prince. He wasn't doing anything illegal. He wasn't doing it. He just wanted to stop hurting.
Yeah, but Prince, in a way, in a very sad way, what did the report say? Didn't the report say just recently that he died because of certain medications?
He took an overdose of an opioid painkiller. He didn't have it adjusted, and it killed him, just like that. Which, of course, should be an incredible testimony to, we've got to get off these meds. We are hooked by Big Pharma. Take a pill for everything. And your personal story, Yuri, is about individual integrity and consciousness and the ability of the individual to be supreme.
Absolutely. And I have to tell you this, that when I get, this is important to get into this interview, I get 300 emails a day. You know, my email address is on my website, so people get to me if they get on my website, they find my email and they email me. So I get around 300. I try to answer them all. Many of them come from teenagers, kids from around the world. And they all want to know, oh, Mr. Geller, can you teach us how to bend the spoon? And my answer is, forget spoon bending. Instead, focus on school, become a positive thinker, believe in yourself, create a target goal to go to university, never ever smoke, never ever touch drugs, and think of success. So in a capsule, that is my message. And I also say to people that, hey, we are the architects of our own lives. We are the architects of our own lives. So we can shape and form our life. If you can go there with your mind, Richard, you can go there with your body. Mm. Whatever you can visualize, you can materialize. So I'm asking all our listeners, all your listeners, Richard, to follow these rules if you can. And when you wake up every morning, put yourself in an attitude of gratitude, and then you will feel much happier. And then very powerful, good, positive things will come into your life.
Excellent words. You know, we're talking to people in 92 countries this morning. 92 countries. We are a planetary family. What are some of the things? 92 countries.
Very important, because 9 and 2 is 11.
Yes, of course. And 11 is tetrahedral.
Yeah, and if you check out my website, you will see an article that I wrote that is titled, If Your Eyes Are Attracted to 11-11.
Hmm.
You're going to see and feel the most amazing phenomenon, because it will start happening to you when you read that article.
Hmm.
It's a positive phenomenon. I can't quite explain it, but did you ever hear of the 11-11 phenomenon, Richard?
Yeah, of course, and I know how it works. George Noory, decades ago, asked me, what's this about 11-11? So after a decade or two, I figured it out. It's the physics. 11-11 is a mathematical variation of 19.5. 19.5 is the hypersphere inscribed tetrahedral angle of the hyperdimensional torsion field physics, which basically is about ether. Consciousness is in the ether. Spoon bending is manipulating the energies of the ether in the matter of the materials. So it's all connected to 19.5, which is really all about 11-11, which goes back to 11.
Yes, and what is quite amazing is that if you look at certain individuals who are very famous, like, for instance, the Pope, Pope Francis is 11 letters. Barack Obama is 11 letters. Clinton is 11 letters. I mean, I can go on and on and on. President Bush was 11 letters. Actually, their whole name comes to 11 letters. Jesus Christ, just count the letters. JESUSCHRIST equals 11 letters. Nostradamus, 11 letters. George W. Bush, 11 letters. Bill Clinton, 11 letters. Jimmy Carter, 11 letters. I mean, I can go on and on and on and on. Even John Kennedy, let's count the letters. J-O-H-N.
Okay, so we have patterns. We have patterns. We have patterns, all right? That says that the universe is patterned. These resonances are in the physics. So when I asked you the question before, have you noticed your talents changing over time? And you said they're getting stronger. That's part of this 19.5/1111 physics, which is modulating everything. I mean, one of the hackneyed cliches that I've been using about it is it's making the good get better and the bad get worse.
Amazing, you know, because my wife, Hannah, her name is Hannah, and I'm trying to count your name. How many count the names of your name?
RichardHoagland without my middle initial.
So how many letters does that come to?
I haven't counted in so long. And I'm not going to do it on the air live. Do you want to take any calls, and do you have any projects we should...
Yeah, we still have a few minutes, so if you want to have any calls...
Well, there's someone who's been incredibly persistent.
Wait, and then my wife, Hannah, who just jumped up and says, oh, my name also equals 11 letters, so...
Well, okay.
Why, can you pass a few calls through?
We're going to try. Good morning, you're okay. On the air.
Yeah, hi, Richard. Hi, Yuri. This is Dana calling from California.
It's the famous
hi,
Dana...
Meeting you over the phone.
Dana created our Club 19.5. Dana, go ahead, please.
Yeah, Yuri, it's funny. I kind of feel like a kid talking to you. I grew up in the 70s, and actually, I just want to thank you for kind of instilling in me sort of a curiosity, sort of a... I feel like it tonight. I just feel like a kid listening to you again, that there's all these possibilities that can happen, and I just wanted to thank you for that.
Hey, that's really nice of you. You know that I have two children, Natalie, who lives in Los Angeles. She's now visiting us with our granddaughter called Romy. And my son Daniel is a prosecutor in England. And they interviewed my son Daniel just recently here in Israel in one of his visits. And the presenter asked him, Daniel, tell me, do you believe in your father's powers and in his incredible story? And Daniel said kind of, you know what, yeah, if he has powers, that's great. But if it's all a show, then it's even bigger. So I was so kind of surprised and astounded to hear that coming from Daniel. So at the end of the day, Dana, whatever moved you in the 70s and now, the spoon bending really is almost like a symbol. It's really not important. What is important in life is to stay positive and hopeful and loving and stay with your family and keep your friends near you and believe that good things will come into your life and then good things will happen and pour over to others. That's the way I look at life today, and I have to because there's so much misery going around us.
Mm. Yeah, and Yuri, I wanted to ask you, there was another person who was studied by SRI as well, and all of his stuff was documented. Did you have any interaction with Ingo Swann?
Yes, I did, of course. We were there together almost the entire time. He lived there. I lived in New York. But Ingo was an amazing, amazing individual. He was also a great artist, by the way. I don't know if you knew that. He painted incredible landscapes of space, and I
didn't know
many
that.
Time asked,
so,
how did you?
Ingo Swann was actually a space artist.
He was a painter.
I've never seen
and,
his art.
I asked him, "How do you get this kind of vision onto a canvas?" And he said to me, "I travel with my mind." So he traveled with his mind to outer space. I don't think anyone knows this, and he brought back this information. And he put it on canvas. He painted it.
Wow.
So, yeah, he was a great person, one of the very few individuals who had very deep and powerful psychic powers.
There must be all kinds of interesting clues then in his art, like there is in Alan Bean's artwork.
Correct. When you look at the Ingo Swann's paintings, you are drawn and you're catapulted into outer space.
Interesting. Okay, we have another member of our listening family. Darren from Canada is calling. Darren, good morning.
It's from Oregon. Yeah. Hi, Yuri. Nice
Hi, good morning, Darren.
Nice to talk to you. Hey, what is your gut feeling about the anomalies on the Moon, the Mars, and Pluto?
Look, because I knew Edgar Mitchell well, we stayed friends for forever until the day he died. I spoke to him just a few weeks before that, and Ed Mitchell started my whole career. And we used to talk about certain visitations on by extraterrestrial beings on other planets. And he was very open-minded. Now, you know, there are certain anomalies on this on the Moon. You know, the face, the famous face on the Moon.
That's actually on Mars.
I'm an open-minded person.
Yuri, the face on Mars, not the face on the Moon. It's at Cydonia on Mars.
I didn't hear that. There was a disturbance here. Say that again.
I said the face on Mars, not the face on the Moon. It's at Cydonia on Mars. But there are all kinds of crystal artifacts and strange things on the Moon that I think Mitchell knew about, but he couldn't talk about.
No doubt. Am I wrong in my what I said, that there was a face on the Moon that was a shadow of something, or was that on Mars?
No, the face is on Mars at Cydonia. There are other structures on the Moon, but no faces, thank goodness.
Okay, then I was mixed up. Yes, Ed Mitchell was totally and utterly open to the possibility that there is life out there and we are being visited. And he believed that we also had a landing, and Ed Mitchell was very adamant and very clear and many times ridiculed by his belief system that higher intelligence have visited and landed on planet Earth.
And on that note, I'm afraid our program is concluded. Yuri, thank you so much for spending 2 hours in the crack of dawn over there with us. We'll definitely want to have you back, because I do want to do some tests with our Accutron torsion field technology, and it would be a perfect time for you to maybe do something thousands of miles away. We could measure it here, and I really look forward to that.
Lovely, lovely, love you all. Thank you very much. God bless, and goodbye.
Thanks, Yuri. Goodbye. Good morning. Good night, wherever you are. Well, everyone, until next week, same bat time, same bat channel. We will see you on Tuesday morning with Joseph Farrell. Don't miss that one. Be here or be square. And again, remember, third star on the left, straight on till morning. Good night, everyone, and have a great weekend.